Okay, so in this talk, I'm going to talk about the EMV protocol. This is how the security protocol is known, but in each of the countries that EMV is used in, it's known by something different. In the UK, it's known as chip and pin, but elsewhere it has different names. But essentially, they're all the same system at heart. The system was developed by Europay, MasterCard, and Visa, and that's where this name's come from. And it's used pretty much all over the world. The only exception is the US. It's used for both credit and debit, although not all countries use that. And it's also used for both point of sale and ATM transactions. So the overall scheme is smart card payments. And as of this year, there are 750 million cards currently deployed. That's comparable to the number of internet-connected computers. But if you compare the amount of an analysis that's gone into EMV compared to SSL and TLS, it hasn't got the attention that it deserves. The reason that I've got interested in this is that almost on a weekly basis, someone comes to me or one of my colleagues and says that they've lost some money from their account and the bank isn't giving their money back. The reason the banks say is because EMV is infallible. Therefore, if the computer says that your card made a transaction, then that card did do the transaction, and therefore it's your personal liability. You're responsible. What they'll often try to do is blame your friends and family. They'll say that someone else had accessed your card and used it without your authorization. And this is a big problem. At the last British crime survey, they found that 44% of fraud victims didn't get all of their money back. Some lost a little bit of money, but some lost a lot. I was talking to one just a few weeks ago who lost £10,000 and the bank haven't refunded them. So to understand how well chip and pin is doing, we can look at the fraud figures. Here, the UK is quite good because they publish quite detailed figures on the losses to the industry. And what we're mainly interested in is the period during which chip and pin was deployed. So it started in about 2002, but cards are expensive, and the bank didn't want to replace everyone's cards all at the same time. So they rolled out gradually, and the rollout was complete by 2005. I'm going to look at three different types of fraud. The first is counterfeit. This is someone making a copy of your card and then using it for fraudulent purposes. Then there's lost and stolen, where someone steals the card from you. Either they mug you or they find your bag or break into your car, get your card somehow, and then use it for purchases. And then finally, there's mail non-receipt. This is where the bank is sending you the card, and then the fraudster takes it out of the mail or redirects it somehow and then uses that card for fraudulent purposes. The chip and pin system is designed to defend against all of these, but in different ways. The chip has a cryptographic key which is used for carrying out the rest of the protocol, and the chip is designed not to release this key, and that makes these cards harder to copy compared to the magstripe system that came before. So the chip tries to protect against counterfeit fraud. But it doesn't protect against lost and stolen because, obviously, someone who has the card has the chip. So that's why the PIN was introduced, to prevent lost and stolen cards and mail non-receipt. In order to carry out a transaction with a chip and PIN card, you have to type in the correct PIN, or at least that's what was hoped. So if we look at how well these two measures have done, it looks fairly good in terms of the PIN. So lost and stolen has gone down, and mail non-receipt has gone down. But in terms of the chip, it's not quite as good, because as the chip and pin system was rolled out, fraud went down initially, but then it started going up as the criminals started to adapt. I talked about this in 25C3, where I showed that it's possible to put a paperclip into one of these devices and then read someone's card number and their PIN, and then use this to create a fake card. And that's exactly what criminals have been doing. But now if you look at card-not-present fraud, that was something that chip and PIN was not designed to defend against. Card-not-present is internet orders or mail orders. Any sort of transaction where the card is not being physically presented to the person you're buying something off. And here you can see that fraud rocketed. As criminals found out that they weren't able to carry out their old types of fraud, they adapted. And then they did things like phishing attacks, where they would send you an email and ask for some card details, or do any number of different things, such as breaking into merchants and getting card numbers from them, and then using these for fraud online. So overall, the fraud figures after the introduction of chip and PIN was fraud increased. But things started changing last year. For the first time ever, card-not-present fraud went down. One suspicion of why this was is the banks introduced something called Verify by Visa. MasterCard has a similar system called Secure Code. And here, you have to type in a password when you're going through the final stages of your online transaction. And that means that if you just get someone's card number, then that doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be able to carry out online transactions. But it's not just the card-not-present fraud that went down. Last year, counterfeit fraud went down. And again, this is the first time ever, except just after the introduction of chip and PIN. Here, the reason is believed to be that although chip and PIN was introduced many years ago, it wasn't mandatory. It meant that if someone could steal your card details, for example, as I demonstrated, taking them out of a chip and PIN terminal, you might not be able to use those. You wouldn't be able to use those details in the UK, but you could take them abroad. What's happened now is it's much harder to use a non-chip and PIN card outside of the UK or outside of the country it was issued. The bank will quite likely turn it down unless you've told them that you're travelling. So that made life harder for the fraudsters. And if we look at the fraud figures overall, it starts to look fairly positive last year. The exception is online fraud. That's the blue line at the top. That's the only one that's been increasing. And I talked about that at last year's CCC, that even though many of the UK banks have deployed a system for doing using your EMV card for online banking authentication, it's not working all that well because fraud has continued to increase. The only time it decreased was in 2007, and that was because one bank was responsible for over 80% of all fraud. They just didn't have a good enough security team, and 2007 was the year that they managed to get their act together. But since then, it's just been increasing again. Now, this starts to look fairly positive. Some fraud's gone down, some fraud's gone up, but the overall figures is gone down. In 2008, it was £704 million, and in 2009, it's £529. But this picture only tells part of the story. This figure only lists losses to shops and losses to the bank. It doesn't include that 44% of customers who don't get their money back. So could there be a change there? Well, once, for example, the Verify by Visa system was introduced, not only was this extra password added, but also the terms and conditions were changed. And here's an extract from one of them, from the Royal Bank of Scotland. They say that you understand that you're financially responsible for all uses of RBS Secure. So before the system came in, if you were the victim of a card-not-present fraud, you would almost certainly get your money back. Now that's no longer the case. So maybe some of that drop, or all of that drop, is due to customers losing rather than the banks losing. And it's a very similar story when it comes to chip and PIN. This is a statement from American Express where they were denying a customer a refund, and they said something like chip and PIN charges cannot be disputed as the card would have to be in possession when the charges were put through. So basically, because chip and PIN is infallible, the card must have been there, you must have typed in the right PIN, therefore it's your fault. Well, it turns out the banks were wrong.
We will stay with the question of money, because most of us don't think twice about paying for something in a high street shop by keying in our PIN. It's easy, it's fast, and in most cases it works. But scratch a little under the surface and there are persistent reports of people who say they've been the subject of fraud of one kind or another on their credit card or their debit card. Now a team of computer scientists at Cambridge University has found a flaw in Chip and Pin so serious they think it shows that the whole system needs a rewrite. Our science editor Susan Watts has the story.
We have to question the entire architecture that's around Chip and Pin.
It really is time for a closer look to be taken in this whole area.
This flaw is really a whopper. Well, we think this is one of the biggest flaws that we've ever uncovered, that has ever been uncovered against payment systems. And, you know, I've been in this business 25 years. This is a flaw on a system that's used by hundreds of millions of people, by tens of thousands of banks, by millions of merchants.
So how does the attack work?
Essentially what it does is exploit a flaw in the chip and pin system that allows the terminal to think that a correct pin was entered and the card to think that a signature authorized the transaction. So at the end, the receipt says verified by pin. The bank is going to think that the pin was entered correctly, but the criminal actually did not know the pin.
Cambridge University gave us permission to see if the attack works in real life. The team set up in one of the university's cafeterias. We obviously don't want to give out too much detail, but in simple terms, SAR is hooking up the stolen card to a chip. This is controlled from a laptop and runs software written by the team. All of this is hooked up to a fake card which slots into the actual shop terminal. The kit wouldn't have to be this big. The team's already working on miniaturizing it into a unit the size of a remote control. SAR has a trick up his sleeve. His dummy card has a concealed cable running up his arm to the kit in his backpack. So will it work?
Hello.
He doesn't need to know the actual pin from the stolen card. Any combination should do. The stolen card is getting a message that the purchase has been authorized by signature. This mismatch should allow the transaction to go ahead. And yes, it does. The printout states it's been verified by PIN. In fact, SAR tried a handful of high street debit and credit cards, keying in 0000 as the PIN, and it worked every time. So is this attack happening in the real world? The Consumers Association thinks Chip and Pin has helped to bring down instances of card crime, but many cases remain unexplained.
It's very difficult to quantify exactly how big this problem is. What we do know from our investigations is that, say, around 14% of consumers on a representative basis will have said that they have suffered some kind of financial loss, which they believe is through fraud. The percentage of that which is actually from this type of potential problem with chip and pin is something that's a lot less clear. What we do know is that we do have cases that are brought forward from individuals which seem quite persuasive.
We understand that behind the scenes, some of the banks are already working on fixing this flaw, but they obviously haven't all fixed it yet, because the banks didn't alert any of us to the purchases we made using the Cambridge attack, our cards, and a PIN 0000.
Okay, so let's see what's actually going on there when we carried out that attack. The EMV protocol is complicated. It's ridiculously complicated. It's 4,000 pages long from the specifications that are publicly available, and there's more secret specifications which go into more detail. So this is radically simplified, and also here I'm talking about how it's used in the UK and a few other countries. This isn't necessarily universal. The first stage is called card authentication. Here, the card presents to the terminal a digitally signed certificate, an RSA signed certificate that gives its card number, the cardholder name, and a few other bits and pieces. Then the customer is asked to enter in the PIN, and then the terminal sends to the card the PIN exactly as it's been entered by the customer. The card checks whether it's correct and then sends a yes or no answer back. Now, that answer isn't authenticated. It's simply yes or no. Then there's transaction authorization, and this is really the core of the protocol. So the terminal sends to the card a description of the transaction, so the amount, the currency, what type it is, the date, and a few other little things, and then the card calculates a MAC over it, a message authentication code, normally triple DES, and then sends that to the terminal. Now the terminal has a choice whether it should go online or not, whether it should contact the bank which issued the card. In the UK and most other countries, in almost every case, sometimes in every case, it will contact the bank. And in this talk, I'm only talking about online transactions, where the MAC and the transaction is sent to the bank which issued the card. The bank checks this according to their records. It makes sure the keys are correct and the contents are what they expect. They also make sure you have enough money in your account, and then send an answer back to the terminal to say whether this should go ahead, and that is authenticated. But clearly, that isn't working. So what went wrong? Well, if we look at the system in a bit more detail and look at what is actually sent to the card, well, there's the amount, there's the currency, there's the date, there's a nonce, it's a random number, and then there's a TVR. And the TVR is the thing that contains the terminal's view of how this transaction went, whether anything went wrong, and if something went wrong, what was it? And byte 3 within here deals with the PIN. And it answers questions like, did the PIN verification fail? And was the PIN required and not entered? Now, if we look at the bit of the spec which actually talks about it, although this is really the core of the protocol, it's only in the Annex C5 in a little table at the back. And there's not very much detail. This is all there is that's available. And the two fields that I'm interested in are there's bit 5, which is PIN entry required and PIN pad present or not working. Now, what does this actually mean? What does it mean that PIN entry is required? I couldn't find anywhere else in the spec where it clearly said, what did it mean? Does it mean the card requires it? Does it mean the terminal requires it? Does it mean the terminal can do it and thinks it should? So there's a little bit of vague details in there. And the case is very similar for bit 4. So I probably spent about a day trying to work out what this meant because I was trying to implement a compatible version. But the people who are working for terminal manufacturers don't have that luxury of time. They can't spend a day deciding whether to set a bit or not. So I thought it was reasonable that if I spent that amount of time doing it, then maybe some terminal manufacturers would get it wrong. And maybe in that case, the banks would not be able to use this TVR to detect whether the PIN was entered correctly. So I think one reasonable explanation for it is if the PIN is not required, then make the TVR all zeros. Because it's not required, you don't need to set the bit. But on the other hand, if the PIN is entered correctly, then the TVR is still zero because it was required, but it was set correctly. So these two cases where, one, the PIN is not required, and two, the PIN is correct, look the same from the bank's perspective. So that means that a man in the middle can change the result of PIN verification, and the bank won't be able to tell what's going on. And that's exactly what we did. And what this allows criminals to do is to steal a card that they don't know the PIN, but still make the bank think that the PIN was entered correctly. So how we actually do this? Well, firstly, we build a bit of hardware for doing the man-in-the-middle attack. And we used an FPGA board for doing the low-level electrical interface, and then we used a PC running some Python scripts for doing the software side of things. And we put this on the backpack, which you saw. But in fact, it's very, very simple. All it's doing is having a malicious card shown in red, which is able to talk to the real card. The first stage of the transaction is card authentication. So here, we relay the messages between the real card and the terminal without modifying them. So the digital signatures still work out fine. The criminal then enters in 0000 or anything. It doesn't really matter what he types in. The terminal will then send that 000 to the man in the middle device, and then it sends back to the terminal the answer yes. It will always answer yes. and we never send that PIN to the card. We never ask it anything to do with PINs. And then transaction authorization continues just as normal. We don't modify any messages coming in. We don't modify messages coming out. So that means that the message authentication codes will still be valid. Therefore, when the MAC is sent to the bank for verification, they will come back and they will say yes. They can't tell what's been going on. So to see why they can't spot what's going on, let's have a look again at the actual definition of the transaction. So you've got all the usual things, and here's the TVR. Well, the TVR has got a bit that says, did the PIN verification fail? Well, the card doesn't think PIN verification failed, it just wasn't attempted. And that will happen legitimately. Some terminals don't have PIN pads. Some terminals have a PIN pad that's broken, and the EMV system was designed to allow it still to continue in those cases. Also, some customers cannot enter in a PIN. You can get cards which have a flag that says, I don't accept PINs because maybe this person is disabled and isn't able to properly use a PIN pad. So these cards exist. From the terminal's perspective, of course it didn't fail because it got the answer back from what it thinks is a real card, which says that the verification succeeded. Then there's a question, was the PIN required and not entered? Well, here, the card doesn't think it's required because of all these cases where it's not, and the terminal doesn't think it's required and not entered because it was entered. So in all those cases, it's perfectly happy. So we told the banks about this. We practiced responsible disclosure. We told them about it in November 2009 and offered to help them try to fix the problem, understand the problem, and we heard nothing. Nothing happened whatsoever. Then 3 months later, we spoke to some journalists, it went on the news, and then things started happening. Yeah. The bank still didn't talk to us, but they did release a press release. This is from the UK Cars Association, who act as spokesman for the banking industry in the UK. So the first thing they said is that when a card company receives a claim about a fraudulent transaction, they will always rely on the primary evidence to review the facts, and they would never use a paper receipt for evidence. Because remember, in this case, the paper receipt will say the PIN was verified correctly, and supposedly the banks will not rely on that. But it turns out that claim is just simply wrong. Here's a letter, again, from American Express, where you can see that there's a disputed transaction here for a few thousand pounds, and it says that we were provided a copy of the till receipts confirming these charges were verified by PIN. And in this particular case, the only evidence that Amex have that this was a PIN-verified transaction is these receipts. But these receipts aren't worth the paper they're written on because of this flaw in the protocol. The Cards Association also said that the industry is confident that forensic signature of such an attack is easily detectable within the data available at the time of the transaction. So, is this always the case? Well, here's another transaction which was being disputed. This was for someone on holiday, and there was £8,000 worth of foreign currency taken out from his account. And then they say that these are computerized records, so you can rely on them. And also, according to our records, all successful transactions were authorized with a genuine card and the correct personal identification number. Well, fortunately, this customer is able to get a copy of the receipt that was generated by the shop in these cases. And here's a copy of it. And it's got these cryptic hexadecimal characters at the bottom. But if we zoom in on byte 3 in there, which is a 08, and going back to that table, that says the PIN entry was required, the PIN pad was present, but the PIN was not entered. So the banks don't know. So either the banks aren't keeping proper records, or they don't know how to interpret their records to know when the PIN was entered in correctly or not. And finally, they said that neither the banking industry nor the police have any evidence of criminals having the capability to deploy such sophisticated attacks. Our research suggests that criminal interest in chip-based attacks is minimal at the time, as they are unable to find ways to make sufficient amounts of money from any of the plausible attack scenarios. Yeah. So this is essentially, criminals are stupid. So one of the objections to our attack is that criminals wouldn't be able to do this because they'd have to carry a backpack into a shop, and somehow shops don't like that. So they said that in order for criminals to do that, they would need to shrink it. And this is far too sophisticated for them because criminals can't make miniature electronics, but then there's skimmers and all those things that have mobile phones and all sorts of very clever things that they're perfectly capable of doing. So one of our master's students, Omar Chowdhury, looked at how difficult it was to build one of these things, and that's what he came up with. So this is about the same size as a pack of cards, and it's got a battery, it's got a screen and a card reader and a fake card coming off the other side. The main reason he built this was not to develop a device that was designed for use in fraud, but to help prevent it. So what this does is, if you use it in a transaction, it will tell you what the card is really seeing, because criminals have compromised chip and PIN terminals, and that would allow them to commit a type of fraud where you think you're paying one amount of money, because that's what's being displayed on the screen, but the card is authorizing vastly larger sum of money. So with this device, it was able to keep a log of the transactions, so you've got evidence if you're going to get in dispute, and it's got a screen, so it will show you the transaction. And it's got a few buttons, and you can say, do you authorize this or not? And we've tried some demos with that. But in addition, because it sits between a card and a terminal, it's able to write a little bit of extra software for carrying out this attack. It's based around an AVR-8 microcontroller, so it's quite easy to work with. And I can show you a video of this where it was demonstrated on French TV.
Bancaire dont il ne connaît pas les codes.
Ok, je prends celle-là.
Sans code, il ne peut théoriquement pas s'en servir.
Il faut d'abord introduire la carte ici. Ensuite, vous allumez l'appareil. Et voilà, nous sommes prêts pour la transaction.
Direction un centre commercial de Cambridge. Dans un grand magasin multimédia, Omar s'amuse à faire son shopping.
J'ai pris Avatar, je crois que c'est pas mal. Et Ninja Assassin. Je ne sais pas ce que c'est, mais j'adore la jaquette. Bon, maintenant, au tour des livres. Harry Potter pour ma femme.
Ça fait combien en tout?
Environ 50 livres.
Vous pensez que ça va marcher?
Vous verrez bien.
Puis c'est le passage en caisse. Omar va utiliser le piège à carte bleue, dissimulé sous sa manche.
€57,98, s'il vous plaît.
Le chercheur paye. Le caissier ne remarque rien d'anormal.
Je rentre n'importe quel code.
4 fois 0, ce n'est pas le bon code. Et pourtant...
C'est bon?
Oui, c'est bon.
C'est bon. So that demonstration was done in October 2010, which is almost a year since the representatives of the French banking industry said that this attack doesn't work on French cards. So that brings us into December 2010. So this is now over a year since the banks were first notified. And now, for some reason, the UK Cards Association tried a little bit of a different tack. They tried to remove the documents from the web. This is a section from their letter. It's all available online if you want to read the full thing. They said that it is the publication of this level of detail which we believe breaches the boundary of responsible disclosure. Essentially, it places in the public domain a blueprint for building a device which purports to exploit a loophole in the security of chip and PIN. Consequently, we would ask that this research be removed from public access immediately and hope that you can give us some comfort about your policy towards future disclosures. So it's hard to know where to start when in explaining how wrong this is. So the first thing is it doesn't place in the public domain a device which carries out this fraud. The website where Omar gives away the source code and schematics for this device very clearly says that he did not include the code for carrying out this attack. Also, I don't think this breaches responsible disclosure. This is, we gave the banks 3 months' notice in private, and it's now been over a year since they were notified, and so far only one UK bank has fixed it. The rest of the banks are still as vulnerable as they were when we first told them. So it didn't get very much traction within the university, and Ross Anderson wrote a letter back. It's well worth reading the full one, it's quite fun, but here's one of the sections. Second, you seem to think that we might censor a student's thesis which is lawful and already in the public domain simply because a powerful interest finds it inconvenient. This shows a deep misconception of what universities are and how we work. Cambridge is the university of Erasmus, of Newton and of Darwin. Censoring writings that offend the powerful is offensive to our deepest values. And what happens when you have some censorship? You have media coverage. So we managed to get on Reddit, Slashdot, Independent, Heise, Mail Online. And when I looked this morning, there were 103 news articles about this story. And if we want to see the effect this has on suppressing information, here's the downloads of it. So I think it's fair to say that it's been highly counterproductive to try to remove this material from the web. Okay. So I think this all comes back to the original claim at the beginning of my talk. I think one of the major reasons that the UK bank industry has been trying to remove this material is not because it is going to help criminals. The criminals already know how to build these sorts of devices. It's not hard. But what it does do is harm the bank credibility when they try to refuse customers being refunded. And we've already heard people who have been able to use the material that we presented in order to get their money back. But there's still a lot more to do. One open question is, a lot of fraud is happening in ATMs, and this type of attack doesn't work against ATMs, because the way ATMs work is when you put in your card and type in your PIN is then encrypted and sent back to your bank, and they then check it. So we can't interfere with that. But still, we get people coming to us very regularly who say that their card hasn't been stolen, yet money has been withdrawn from an ATM, and then they haven't got their money back. We know how some of these are explained. There was one from a customer of Santander Bank. It was Abby at the time, Emma Wolfe, and she had money taken from her account from an ATM. The bank said that it must have been her or her fiancé who had access to the card, and they wouldn't give her money back. But then, after quite a long battle, the police arrested one of the bank employees, and it turned out that bank employee was able to issue a second card under that person's name and then make the fraudulent withdrawals. So maybe that is happening, and maybe the banks are denying it, but we're not really sure. And then there's a lot more in the EMV specification. There's 4,000 pages of it. I'm sure there are some other bugs in there. One thing that we haven't looked at, which is quite closely linked to Ralph's talk on attacking baseband, is how well do terminals work when faced with some corrupted data. The it has all the same bad properties. The EMV protocol has all the same bad properties as GSM. A lot of the data is in ASN1 format, which is very hard to write a decoder for. I've got an implementation of it, and then the first few versions of it, it would regularly say that it's expecting 10 billion bytes. And the reason is that there are two ways of encoding length in the EMV protocol. The first one is a single byte, and where the most significant bit is zero, and that will get you up to 127 bytes. But for anything longer, you need to have the most significant bit set, and now the rest of that byte is not the length of the data, but the length of the length. And then you have more bytes that come along later on, which say how big that length really is. But that means that it's very easy to trigger a terminal code to do a memcopy or some operation in a vast number of bytes. And that might be one way of trying to attack the terminals or ATMs. It's harder to attack the cards because the cards do very little processing. But even those still do have bugs. For example, it's been well known in Germany that at the beginning of last year, some sort of bug in the card, I don't know the detail, stopped it working. There's some suspicion it's to do with a year being incorrectly interpreted as hexadecimal. So I think there's a lot more scope for doing these sorts of investigation, and that's where the device that Omar's built could be very useful. The software is freely available. It's quite easy to manufacture the hardware, and it's something for you to experiment with. Okay, so I think I'll take some questions now and let the people who are standing sit down.
Anybody wants has questions, so please line up left and right to the microphones. And does the internet have any questions? Okay. So
the first question is in the beginning of the presentation, you said that the fraud went down in 2009, and that this possibly had to do with the added security measures. But in 2009, Albert Gonzalez and friends got busted, which were big players in the carding scene, and around 130 million stolen card numbers. Is this possible that the change in fraud is just because these guys left in the carding game?
It's certainly a possibility. The numbers he was dealing with were quite large, but in terms of the overall levels of fraud, I'm not sure if that's enough to explain that very large drop. But yes, it's certainly a possibility.
You've been talking about the EMV protocol all the time, but at least in Germany, there are those wireless pin pads or terminals.
Yes.
Have you ever looked at that?
So in Germany,
I think they're using GSM. I don't know, but
so in Germany, the cards are EMV. There's several different applications on these smart cards, but some of them are EMV. We haven't looked at the protocol that's used for communicating between the terminal and the rest of the network. That's sometimes GSM. It's sometimes Bluetooth. We don't really know what's being sent on there. The right approach would be to do encryption. We don't know whether they're doing that. And also, it matters what's being sent over it. So the PIN should certainly never be sent over that communication line. The PIN should go only to the card. But it's possible the card number is being sent unencrypted over that line, and that can still leak some sensitive information.
There are nowadays some NFC-based payment methods, such as PayWave and PayPass from Visa and MasterCard. Mm-hmm. Do you know anything about the security of these and whether they may be susceptible to the same sorts of attacks that you described?
So we haven't looked into that yet, but it's something that we're definitely going to do. It's a little bit more difficult because for all its flaws with... For all EMV's flaws, one advantage it does have is the publication, the specification is publicly available, certainly most of it. You can go to emvco.com and download it. That's not the case with contactless systems. Okay. The spec is not public. So we're going to have to, first of all, reverse engineer it, understand how it works, and then see which of these attacks is going to apply. We just don't know for now. We know it's very similar to EMV, but it's got some differences.
Okay, thank you.
Another question from the IRC. Mm-hmm. What are you saying is that when the PIN is never needed to unlock the secret key inside the chip used to create a MAC?
Yes, in EMV that is never the case. The PIN can be used in two different ways. One is the PIN can go to the card. The card will check it, send a yes or no answer, and it will also update its state internally. And that state will then be used as part of the input of the MAC. But a card will never refuse to produce a MAC. It will always produce a MAC. It just constrains what's going to be put into it. The other way the PIN is used is where it doesn't go to the card, it goes to the bank. And then the bank can check it, and it can also send the message back to the card, which will update its internal state. So it's not like many smart cards where you have to type a PIN in to unlock it. All the PIN does is sets a flag inside.
So I'm wondering where in the process is stored which bank the reader talks to, or does this just talk to the MasterCard? Because I'm wondering whether you could build a chip that invents a new bank, and you can impersonate that bank and draw money from nowhere.
So there's a few systems going on. So one is that of the bank identification number. The first six digits of your account number identifies your bank, and then either the terminal or the system the terminal connects to has a list of which bank controls which bin, and that controls how they're going to route the transaction. The other way is that I mentioned at the beginning of the transaction, you have this transaction authorization stage. I'll go into that. The card authentication stage, where the certificate is sent, includes a RSA digital signature, and that is signed by the card scheme. So that's MasterCard or Visa or Amex. And that is issued by these card schemes to a bank for a certain range of bins. So if you invent another bank, one thing that you might need to do is to get one of these certificates, and that's probably going to be a bit tricky. I don't know what sort of authentication these card schemes use. We've found plenty of problems with commercial certification authorities not doing adequate checking. But I don't know what will happen if you give a terminal an invalid certificate or a certificate doesn't exist or just no certificate. It might still accept the transaction. I think it's something that would be worth trying.
Hi.
Another.
Hello. You mentioned that one bank fixed this issue, so I was wondering how to fix it, actually.
So there, in addition to the TVR, there's another flag that is sent called the issuer application data. And this is proprietary between the person who made the card and the bank which issued the card. Effectively, it's the same organization. And this includes a number of bits, and one of them is the bit that you'd want to have, which is, was the PIN entered correctly or not? So the issuing bank can know whether the PIN was entered correctly or not, but the terminal can't, because the terminal isn't able to parse that field because it doesn't have any defined format. And I think that's how the banks are fixing it. They're using that flag. But although they know whether the PIN is entered correctly or not, they don't know whether it should have been. And a bank cannot do something like reject all transactions where the PIN's not entered, because there are plenty of cases where the PIN will not be entered. There is yet another flag, the terminal status indicator, which says whether the terminal should be able to produce a PIN, but a lot of terminals set this incorrectly. So I think it's not a simple matter of trying to set this flag or examine this flag, but look at all sorts of other indicators which show what the flag should have been before they can reject it. It's very difficult to do this correctly, because if you do it wrong, then suddenly you've got 10,000 people who aren't able to withdraw cash, and then that makes them very, very upset.
I have another question from the IRC. After so much concentrated incompetence by the banks, don't you think it's time for a full disclosure response? Publish the entire tax setup to put some more shame and pressure on them?
Yeah. It's difficult to know what to do in this situation. This is not the first time we've found a vulnerability in Chip and PIN, and what we've always done is give them a few months' notice to see what would happen. I don't think in any of those cases they've fixed it within that time period, and often they haven't fixed it at all, like most of the banks here. I don't know what is the best thing to do. It seems that the regulators in the UK are not very interested in pushing the banks to do anything here. But in terms of publication, we haven't published the attack code, but when I went to implement this was like three extra lines. So once you know what you're doing, it's not very difficult. Literally, you just need to see whether the command coming in is a request to verify the PIN, which I think is 0020. And if it's 0020, then you return 9000, because 9000 is a success code. So I don't think there's any obstacle for criminals from doing this, whether we told them or not.
Okay, just one little additional question. Does that mean that we have to trust the bank to figure out if this transaction was real, or is there anything we can do ourselves?
There's a fairly limited amount of things that the customer can do. Almost everything relies on the bank logs. And often these are not kept, or they're not interpreted correctly. So I was an expert witness in one court case where the bank lost almost all of the logs for that, and they just had one byte left which said what was going on, but they wouldn't be able to give us an instruction manual which explained what that byte really meant. So they just effectively said that if it says 2B, it means the client's guilty. And he lost that court case. There are a few things that you can do, and one thing is that if you're the victim of any sort of phantom withdrawal, fraudulent transaction, the bank will ask you to cut up your card. Don't do this. Because one thing that your card does contain is a counter of how many transactions it started. And if, say, for example, you've used your card 10 times, and then the bank shows 20 transactions, 10 of which are fraudulent, then you now have quite good proof that it wasn't your card in use. It doesn't work all the time, because your card will increase this transaction each time you plug it into any sort of system which reads it. So it's not foolproof, but it's better than nothing. So it's definitely a good idea to keep your card around if anything goes wrong with it. Also, there's a facility in the specification for the card storing a log of recent transactions, and that would be very good for consumer protection. I haven't seen any card which actually does this.
Hi. How are you?
Yep.
How do you see skimming? Because I think it's much easier to skim a card than with Eurotech, because you have to get your card to Eurotech, and with skimming you just grab the data and grab the PIN and make a new card and draw some cash from the ATM.
Skimming used to work very well. And that was the reason that counterfeit fraud did not go down. It doesn't work quite as well as it used to. The public figures from the bank, or public statement from the bank, is that they no longer accept MagStripe-only transactions. So if you copy the MagStripe, then you shouldn't be able to use it in an ATM. Now, they've said that, I think, two other times, and it turned out they were wrong. We haven't checked them the third time they said it.
Last month, I've been a victim of skimming, so... last month, so...
Okay.
Yeah.
In what country was the card used?
Canada.
Okay, so Canada is one of the last countries, apart from the US, which is moving towards chip and pin. So I think they will probably in 5 years' time be in the position.
There was some South America.
Yeah. Yeah.
There seems to be another country in South America, I don't remember. Police said there is, I don't know, Mexico or something else.
Yeah. So there are still countries where that will work. Within Europe, I think Italy was the last one to move to full chip and pin. And what that's now causing the banks to do is to view Magstripe's injection as being a lot more suspicious than it used to. So it tunes their fraud detection algorithm a little bit so that they will be more likely to reject a transaction if it's Magstripe only. I'm not too worried about that because that's a decision the bank has to make on the basis of risk versus a reward, provided they are going to pay back to the customer when they're the victim of fraud in that case. The situation that I'm worried about is where the bank computer systems don't adequately distinguish between Magstripe transactions and chip transactions, in which case the customer might lose out. So I think it would be quite interesting to see whether banks are going to, whether the first line support of banks are able to answer that question correctly. This is a very difficult thing to do legally because the appropriate experiment would be we would do a bunch of Magstripe transactions as if it was skimming and then call up the bank and say it wasn't me and then see how many of those we get their money back. That might be considered fraud, so it's not something that we've done.
Another IRC question. Mm-hmm. Are you aware of anybody developing a wireless device for the technique?
I'm not aware of anyone doing that, but I don't think it's very difficult. The communication line is half duplex, it's 10 kilobits a second, so I think it's well within the capabilities of anyone competent who's doing radio. You'd hardly need any components in the fake card because it's going to be such short range and the card already has a 5-volt power supply. So I don't think it would be hard. We haven't done it. We're probably not going to do it, but I don't think it would be difficult.
Will you tell us which UK bank has fixed the problem?
Barclays.
Okay.
So what you created has a certain potential of criminal usage. And my question was, if we want to investigate things in the same corner, or what things, measures do we need to take beforehand, or have you taken, to prove that we want to do white hat research and protect from criminal investigation?
So it's very useful to do this work as part of a university. You do have quite a lot of history that you can go back to and you can quote to Newton and Darwin and Erasmus. So I think being with a university helps. Okay, and the other thing you can do is involve the press. So for example, another part of the letter from the UK Cards Authority was saying that that demonstration that Omar did was... the police had expressed concern. But the advantage that we had is we had a person with a camera standing behind for the entire duration. So firstly, you could see what was going on. And the important thing is that nobody lost out. It was a journalist card which was used, and he authorised what was going on. The journalist received the goods that he wanted, and also the merchant who sold the goods got their money. So no one made any profit out of it. It was all very publicly known, and it looks like it was not anything underhanded. So I think try to involve the press and the university where possible. And a lawyer.
Hello. have a question. Have you come up with anything in your research that would enable the creation of a card that verifies all transactions without any man-in-the-middle attack or any active involvement?
What do you mean, verifying all transactions?
An always-on state. Just send, yes, the PIN was correct, the PIN was required, send that information to a terminal and the transaction positively.
So this is that a cloned card? Or is this a completely cloned card?
For instance, yes.
So we haven't tried what would happen if the card sends the wrong MAC back. That's, in principle, the bank could deny the transaction. We're not sure whether they actually are going to do so. And the card can also send a whole bunch of other flags. So it can say that I don't need a certificate. We don't know what will happen in those cases. It can also say that I can never go online. And will the merchant terminal reject the transaction or just allow it? I think this all comes from EMV being so complicated. There are many, many options which are not being used, doesn't really make sense to use, and it's hard to know how the terminals in the bank systems actually deal with them.
IRC is asking, what reasons are there to keep this specification secret other than their proprietary content?
I haven't seen any rationale given for why this change has come into place, because they're not secret in a good way. Their secret is in that researchers are not able to get access to them. But pretty much everyone who works for a company which is willing to sign a bit of paper is able to get access to them. So it could be that the banks would claim, or the specification owners would claim, that this is to stop criminals getting their hands on it. But I don't think that is actually very effective. Criminals would just have to lie on a bit of paper and then they'd get a copy of the specifications. I don't think there's very much commercially sensitive information in these things. The protocol is very, very similar to EMV, which is already public. There's just a few extra command parameters in here. So I think it's probably more institutional culture that secrecy is good rather than any well-thought-out threat risk analysis decision. Thank you.